when I give news over, it's always news that's verified, and never something that is going to put myself in a compromising position.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
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 With Shai Davidai.
Before we begin, I would like to thank our Patreon supporters who are watching this live as we're recording this. And my guest today is the founder of From the Depth Foundation, a foundation to preserve Holocaust memory and support survivors and the righteous among the nations. He's also the main news source since the October 7 massacre for many, many Jews and non-Jews around the world. And here I am with Johnny Daniels.
Such a pleasure to be here. It's so nice to be able to do this. I'm really happy. Thank
you. I'm glad that we crossed paths and we're in the same continent in the same time.
Because shocking, right?
You are a globetrotter, so I'm glad that you were able to come here. And Johnny, I'm going to start with the question that I ask every guest. Johnny Daniels, what kind of a Jew are you?
What kind of a Jew am I? I hope the answer would be a good Jew. I'm a Jew like every other Jew. And I'm a Jew who believes, and a Jew who's connected to my roots and connected to my history.
And you have an interesting life story. You were born in London. Mm-hmm. You made Aliyah by yourself when you were 18 to join the paratroopers in the IDF. So before we get to everything you've done since then, how did you go from being the good London Jewish boy, studied in yeshiva, to putting all of that behind and going and, you know, not just joining the IDF, but joining a combat unit?
Well, I think a good London Jewish boy is probably a term that I wouldn't necessarily use. I definitely was not a good boy. Israel was always a central part of who I was. From a very young age, Israel was a key part of my Judaism and my being. I remember my first trip to Israel, I was maybe 7 years old with my grandparents, and I was walking down to the beach in Tel Aviv with my grandma on Rehov Bugashov. And I was holding my grandma's hand, and I said, "Grandma," I said, "I want to live here when I'm older." She said, "Remind me in 10 years." I was 17 years old. I said, "Do you remember that conversation we had?" And she remembers. And Israel has always and was always a central part of the essence of what I felt my life direction should be. And so there wasn't any question for me that Israel would be my home. And I just felt connected there. I felt, as someone who grew up in through religious education, it made no sense to me that people could pray three times a day to Jerusalem and not be there. It mm-hmm. was, you know, this is our home, right? I always felt like a guest in any other country I've ever been in. And at Israel, I felt like I'm at home. And it felt to me, there wasn't any question, just absolutely no question that that is where I'm meant to be. And so when I had the opportunity, as soon as I finished school, I was out. I went and I kind of pretended to be in yeshiva for a year. Like a lot of people, at least I'm willing to admit that. I went and I think I spent most of my time in the streets of Jerusalem having fun. And made a lot of Israeli friends. I volunteered with an unbelievable organization called Zichron Menachem, which helps and supports children with cancer. So I worked in the oncology wards of Hadassah Ein Kerem Hospital in Yerushalayim. And being there with the Israeli volunteers, all of whom were my age and getting ready to go to the army, it was like, well, clearly, you know, their blood isn't any different to mine. They're willing to sacrifice and to give for our homeland. I need to as well. And so that was really the step to join the army. And then joining the army, it was obvious to me that I'd give it all I could. And when it came to go to the army, it felt like the right thing was to join into a combat unit. And thankfully, I was accepted into the paratroopers, which was not an easy feat, right? The furthest I think I'd run before the army was for the bus. And suddenly I find myself in the paratroopers unit, which had its own challenges. And the army is not an easy place, as you well know. Especially not for someone who's brought up with it, right? Mm. All the terminology that you understand in Israeli, right. You get there and you're like, what the hell's going on? But it's a great melting pot. And it's the perfect place to be able to understand properly what it means to be an Israeli. And that was important for me.
So a lot of people that will be watching this or listening, I think would find it interesting that you said you've always felt like a guest everywhere else, because you were born and raised in England.
Yep.
You know, part one of the criticism, or I would say more like anti-Semitic criticism, is that Jews behave as guests and they have that double loyalty. Can you explain, like, if you had to explain that to a non-Jew, what does it mean to feel like a guest in your own country? Where does that come from?
Well, I think that we also have to realize that these aren't our own countries. We are guests. And we see that we can fool ourselves, right, to think that we're welcome and to think that places are open to us. And sometimes they are, but that doesn't last forever. You know, one thing that someone once told me is you can forget that you're a Jew all you want, but one day somebody's going to come and remind you. And this, unfortunately, is the position that we find ourselves in. And here in the United States, people are learning that today, right? The golden era of American Jewry is over, right? It doesn't mean that Jews can't still live here and shouldn't still live here and shouldn't feel a part of society. But you see it. You see it with extremists from both the right and the left, right? You see this the narrowing of this gap of understanding of this openness of culture completely disappearing. And Jews have always been guests wherever we've been. We've never been fully welcomed into society. We integrate into society very, very well, unlike other peoples, and we give back and we do so much. But given the opportunity, we always will be the scapegoat. And when you understand and learn Jewish history, that story repeats itself time and time and time and time again, everywhere we've been.
But there are Jews who would say, and I guess maybe many non-Jews would say, well, if you keep the mindset of being a guest, then you will always be a guest. It's our fault that we don't integrate fully, assimilate fully. And you state that even if you try to forget as much as you want, someone will come and remind you. Are they really fooling themselves? Have we ever tried to be fully integrated, fully assimilated? Like, what are your thoughts about that?
I think that there's any question of that. I think even if we look back at British Jewish history, right, which is a history obviously I know well, you could look back to British Jewish prime ministers, right? We had one, which was Benjamin Disraeli, right? Over 100 years ago, came in, converted to Catholicism to push off his Jewish roots and accept the religion of the country. And you look at the state of Jews in the UK today, right? Which is, again, Jews can live there. It's safe and it's okay to be there. But for how much longer, right? And this has been Jewish history time and time again, where we have integrated. We've done everything that we could. The difference now is that we have somewhere to go. And you know what? We have somewhere to go and the food's better and the weather's nicer. And this is something that Jews need to understand, that it's all well and good being a Jew in the diaspora. And it is fine and it is safe, and I'm not being an alarmist or anything like that. However, we do also need to understand that there's a limit to how much we can really progress in these countries, because we're always going to be viewed as the outsider. And it doesn't matter, right? You could be the biggest fig leaf in the world, right? And pull over to the other side and call out other Jews. And we see this all the time. Right, you see this with these far-left Jewish or Code Pink and all these other organizations who are running at the forefront, run sometimes by Jewish people. It doesn't make a difference, right? As someone who studied Jewish history again, and you look at through the times of the Holocaust, right? The Jews who went and worked with the Germans, their fate at the end was exactly the same. They maybe survived a little bit longer, but they were still killed in the same gas chambers as those who were stood up tall and proud. And I think, again, without attempting to be an alarmist, it's more just understanding also essentially who we are and what the world thinks of us.
So, but you travel a lot in the diaspora, speaking to a lot of communities. Do you have a sense of why it's so hard for many Jews to accept that? That, you know, no matter how much we try, like, you are not the exception. Like, 3,000 years of history have gone one way, our generation is not going to change that. Like, why is it so hard for people to understand that?
Because people are so used to this way of life of openness and acceptance, right? The world shifted massively over the last even just 20 years, right? You have this huge understanding of things like mental health and acceptance, and suddenly the whole world is open and understanding of every single community, right? LGBTQ plus, the trans community, we're talking about these things. 80 years ago, people would have been locked up for being, you know, a homosexual. And today it's understandably and rightly open and accepted in society, right? The spectrum that we accept from a perspective of race is also completely open. You look at how African-Americans have achieved massively in America, and rightly so, and in the UK and all around the world, that we see this openness and acceptance for all societies but us. And that's difficult for people to wrap their heads around. And again, it's understandable because we've been brought up and we're a community that accepts everybody. And we're at the forefront of human rights and we're the forefront of pushing for everybody else. What we learned after October 7th was that it doesn't matter how much we march with every other community, when it comes to our turn to be the people marching, we turn around and there's no one marching with us. And I think that people are starting to understand and to see that, and to understand that the only way through this is by accepting our role as Jews and our pride in being Jewish. And this is what's lacking.
So what is our role for you? What do you see as our role as Jews?
Look, I mean, the first thing is that we need to understand that we are an exceptional people. Truly, the Jewish people are a remarkable people. And we need to have so much pride in that. You look at what Jews have done for the world, nobody comes close. Not even close. We're what, 0.2% of the world's population? Look at what we've done. And, you know, you can take the 20% of Nobel laureates who are Jewish and put that to the side. And you just look at what we've given to society. My foundation works with Holocaust survivors all around the world. And I was speaking in Pennsylvania. And I asked if there were any Holocaust survivors nearby. And they told me up in the Poconos Mountains, there's one survivor. And so, you know, not being from here, I was like, cool, I'll go visit him. Right? Not realizing it was like a ridiculous drive. So I borrowed someone's car and started driving up the mountain. And I get to
visit someone you've never met before.
To visit this Holocaust survivor. We have this project with this Torah scroll. We visit the survivors and sit with them and talk to them and get their testimonies and bring them a little bit of love and respect that they deserve. And I get up to the top of this mountain, the Poconos Mountains, and I visit with this man. And I walk into his house and I thought, you know, poor guy, right? He's clearly like a hoarder or something. There were these electrical devices everywhere. I ignored it. You know, he's been through a lot. We sit down and start talking. He was a Ukrainian Jew born in Kiev. Most of his family were killed by Ukrainians in Babi Yar. And he miraculously survived. Came to America with nothing. Most siblings all killed, completely alone. No education either. And so he was looking for something to do, and he was very, very good with his hands. So there's an American company called Cuisinart, which does a lot of the kitchen appliances, and owned by an Italian family. And they were, you know, they were willing to give him a try. And he goes in there. It turns out that this guy's brilliant and holds the patents for so many kitchen appliances that every single person in America uses today. All those products that were lying around were things that he'd built, from kettles to anything you can imagine that goes on in the kitchen, almost all patented by this Jewish man, Holocaust survivor. And I sat there looking at this man who is, unfortunately, his wife passed away. He was completely alone. And I'm thinking, look at what he's given to the world, even just in the field of kitchen appliances. Look at what he's given. Imagine what would have been with his brothers and sisters had they have survived. And you look at what we've given to the world as Jews, you understand how incredible we are. And even in terms of Israel, how much energy and mind we have to put in defense, which is obscene, right? How much of our budget goes to defending ourselves? Imagine if we take that money and put that into science. We would have cured cancer by now.
Imagine if we could. I think it's not that
we want to. Yeah. But imagine if we were able to. And as Jews, what we've given, even with the difficulties that we've had, we still build and give, not just to our own community, but to the entire world. So there's this pride that we need to have as Jews in terms of what we give, right? God instructed us to be an Or LaGoyim, to be a light to the nations. And we really are. We give and we give and we give. And within this understanding of how amazing we are needs to come so much more pride in terms of what it means to be a Jew. That doesn't mean that someone has to necessarily be religious, or it doesn't mean that they have to do anything in particular, but they need to educate their children in terms of this pride that we have to have in being Jewish. And we do need to attach to some level of tradition and understanding, because that's what keeps us. And it's this humanity and it's this decency. Even when we look at the IDF, so many people today are scared to talk about it, right? Because if you look at the American media, all you're going to hear about is, you know, killing babies and genocide and nonsense and lie after lie after lie. But the truth is that we are the most moral army in the world. And it's not just so we can say that, because no one's going to believe us anyway. It's because we have to go home at night. You know what it means to be a soldier in the army. You're going home to your mother, to your father. You're going home to your husband or your wife, and you have to stand tall and proud. When you look at the numbers of Israeli soldiers with things like PTSD, obviously there are, but comparative to American soldiers, the numbers are basically insignificant. That's because we're fighting for something real, and our moral standards are so unbelievably high. And that, again, it doesn't become because we need to, it comes because that's how we are programmed as Jews. We're a moral, good, decent people.
Interesting. It's an interesting point, because I've always had an issue with the that most moral army in the world, because armies shouldn't be moral. Armies are not about being moral or unmoral. They're about, you know, achieving the goal with the least, you know, casualties and the, you know, the biggest impact. But it's interesting what you mentioned, because you've rooted this in, you know, when you're a soldier in the IDF, you don't get sent 6 months or a year, you know, deployed somewhere. You go somewhere, 3 weeks later, you're at Shabbat dinner with your grandma and your mom and your dad, and you need to explain yourself. And you need to really, you know, found yourself in that family. And a lot comes from there.
And that's the morality, right? It's not, again, you know, when people always ask, you know, on October 8th, we could have completely wiped out Gaza. We really could have. And the world would have said, no, no, no. But what could they have done? Right? We had every legitimacy after that to do that. And we didn't. And we wouldn't. And that again falls into the morality of who we are. Right? The fact that every single attack, even now in Gaza, goes through multiple layers before we hit a building, it's unbelievable. What army calls people to leave a building? What army... You know, each attack goes through lawyers. Literally, lawyers look at the level of attack and sign on every single attack of the IDF. When we're looking now, you know, Iran and all these other things that we're dealing with, every single thing plays out in a sense of the least amount of civilian casualties on the other side. And that's because of a level of morality and decency, and that's what's kept us as Jewish people. If we gave that up, we become like everybody else, and we don't have... It's not the essence of who we are as a people. So that morality really comes to the core of what it means to be a Jew.
So, and I want to get a lot to what's happening in Israel since the October 7th massacre, of course. But before that, I want to talk about you, Johnny, before that, because a lot of people, myself included, kind of like came into the Johnny Daniels show in season 4, mm-hmm. not knowing that there were many seasons before that were completely different.
Yep.
You, as I said, you were born and raised in London, moved to Israel for served in the IDF, and then you found yourself relocating at least partially to Poland and starting your foundation. Tell me what happened there.
Well, before that, I mean, I finished my service in the army and I worked for about 7 years in the Knesset, in the Israeli parliament. I was the chief of staff to Danny Danon, who's now Israel's ambassador to the United Nations. I worked with other parliamentarians and ministers as well. And it gave me a very strong understanding also of the political scene in Israel, which is somewhat complex.
somewhat
complex. And it gave me a lot of strong and valuable connections and relationships that have served me very well until today. People who are classed as true friends and across the political spectrum, which is very interesting. You know, it's often we look at politics and we see, you know, you expect that a parliamentarian on one side and the other side, if they see each other in the hallway, are going to have a punch up. The truth is very far from that. you know, usually there's hugging.
They're the only ones talking. Well,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Everybody else is fighting. These guys, they understand it's just politics. And that level of education was extreme for me. I grew up surrounded by Holocaust survivors, you know, like a lot of us in our generation, they were around all the time, right? You'd every Yom HaShoah or Holocaust Memorial Day, there'd be survivors who would come and speak in our schools. You go to the synagogue and you see the numbers on the arm. This wasn't far from us. And when my eldest daughter was born, Michal Sheindel, we called her Sheindel after her great-grandmother, who was a survivor of Auschwitz-Birkenau, who passed away just before she was born. And I looked at my beautiful little girl and I said, who's going to have this impact on her that survivors had on me? And this understanding of Jewish history and this understanding of what we've just been through, only what would have been 70 years ago then. And I looked around, and in terms of Holocaust education, there are amazing organizations doing brilliant things. But from my generation, I didn't see many people doing much. So I started to think more and more about it. Again, I was working in the Knesset at the time, and I'd gone on a trip to Poland with two members of Knesset. And we went and we visited Auschwitz. And as we were walking in Auschwitz, we came across a group from Israel of high schoolers. And they had a survivor with them. And the survivor saw us and burst out crying. And he said, you know what, I've been back so many times, but to be here with members of the Israeli parliament, like that I'd never imagined 70 years ago. That one day I'd stand here with a Jewish parliament, right, representing a Jewish army and a Jewish homeland, like that was so significant for that survivor that it really struck something. And so I came back to Israel and I was really thinking about it. And I said, you know what, we need to hold a session of the Knesset in Auschwitz. And every member of Knesset needs to come with a survivor. So I went to the Speaker of the Knesset and I said, look, I've had this idea. And
who was the speaker at the time?
It was Yuli Edelstein. And he was like, and I went to the Polish embassy and I said, look, you know, what do you guys think about it? And they were like, and so I was like, you know what, that's good enough for me. I sat down with Noah Kliegel. Noah Kliegel was Israel's oldest journalist at the time. He was a survivor of Auschwitz. He was old school. I mean, this guy was a legend of Israeli journalism, to the point where he'd call in his stories like the old days. When he'd have an article to write, he'd call the news desk and whoever answered the phone had to type it up for him. So you have these like super high level journalists. If they answered Noah's call, doesn't matter what they're doing, they're typing up his story for him. And he was an unbelievable man. And I went and sat down with him and I said, look, I have this idea. And he said, Johnny, it's brilliant. And I started thinking about it and thought, okay, like this needs to happen. And Elie Wiesel, Zichrono Livracha, was in Israel at the time. And I went and sat and had breakfast with him in Jerusalem. And I had this idea. I said, look, Elie, I'd like to do this. But you know, who am I? Right. I'm not a survivor, clearly. Right.
If I'm not mistaken, you were not even 30 at the time.
I was 27 years old. I'm nobody, right? I'm not a survivor. I don't have letters before or after my name. I don't have college degrees. I didn't even finish college. Right? Like, how can I do such a thing? University. And he said, no, Johnny, you have to. He's like, if your generation isn't doing enough, he's like, you're my witness. If you don't stand up and act, then everything is going to be forgotten. So I said, okay. So I start putting this together. Noah runs a story on the front page of Idiot Ahronot's weekend edition with a picture of my face saying he has a dream. And I'm like, oh my God, right? Telling this whole story. The problem was is that the Knesset hadn't agreed and the Polish government hadn't invited the Knesset. So you can't, never in history has a sovereign government held a hearing on the grounds of another sovereign government. It hasn't happened. So there's no precedent for it. The Polish government, it'd be pretty weird for them to invite the Israeli government. The Israeli government can't ask the Polish government to. So I basically somehow bamboozled both sides to say, look, a letter's on its way, accept, you have to accept. The press were already starting to ask questions in Israel. That was my strength, that I had journalists calling members of Knesset saying, what do you mean you're not going to Auschwitz? Like, no, I'm going. And on the 27th of January, 2014, for the first time in history, the majority of the Knesset left Israel together and went to Auschwitz. And we held a hearing in Auschwitz with the majority of the Knesset. And that's what spurred me into my foundation.
For many of the listeners and viewers might not know why the 27th.
So the 27th of January is the date of the liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau. It's the date that the Soviet forces liberated Auschwitz. And we held it on the 69th anniversary. And each member of Knesset came with a survivor. And it was an unbelievable day. It was, you know, historic and very, very powerful. Like I said, it was the first time in history that that happened. And it was a very big deal. Like, and, you know, and I, my foundation made that happen. And I presumed that that would be my contribution. And then I'd go back to my work. But, you know, man laughs and, you know, man plans and God laughs. And he laughed at me and spurred me into a whole different thing. I did a lot of media at the time and a lot of media in Poland. And the Polish media were like, who the hell is this 27-year-old kid that made this happen? I did that. As a result of that, tons of people started reaching out in Poland with everything connected to, you know, we have tombstones in our garden, to there's a mass grave around the corner, to I have this, I know that. And it really pushed me in a direction of, okay, well, someone needs to do this. I look around, no one's doing it. I'll do it myself.
So, which brings me to another project with part of your foundation, the Matsuva Project, which translates to the Headstone or Gravestone Project. What is that?
So that started actually directly as a result of this. A Polish journalist took me to a park in the center of Warsaw. Like a public park where kids play on swings and run around and have fun. And he said, you see this park? I said, yeah. He said, it's all made from Jewish tombstones. I said, what are you talking about? So we go to this pergola, this like stone structure and steps, and we flip a stone over, and there's Hebrew writing. I said, my gosh, how is this possible? And he said, look, I mean, people knew about it, the city, whatever. So I said, okay. So I called up the mayor's office in Warsaw. I said, I'd like to have a meeting. I said, sure, see me in the media. I go in for a meeting, and they gave me all the political blah, blah. They didn't realize that I've spent 7 years in politics in Israel. So their blah, blah
is not going to phase you.
Not going to phase me, not really going to work on me either. So I sat there and I listened, and they said, oh my goodness, we never knew about this. Show us on a map where it is. I was like, sure, showed them on a map. Okay, definitely, when we get the budget in, we're going to deal with this. And I said, okay, wonderful. I said, but I think I have to tell you something. And I sat there a bit confused. I said, well, you know, the Jewish Museum's opening quite soon in Warsaw. They were very proud of that. They said, yes, of course we know. I said, every single VIP that comes to that museum, I'm going to take to the park to show them the juxtaposition of how your city works. Then on one hand, you'll build a museum, but on the other hand, you'll trash Jewish history. And they all sat there like that. Shockingly, within about 3 days, they found budget, and they took all the tombstones and returned them to the Jewish cemetery nearby. That was a big story in the Polish media. And then my cell phone started exploding with, we have a tombstone in our garden. We have this, we have that. My whole village's city street is made from Jewish tombstones. So people start calling, we'd go and pick them up and return them. And it would start a process of allowing people this opportunity to do what was right in terms of giving back. Look, when it comes to a stone, it's interesting because from like a religious perspective, there's no kedusha. There's no holiness to a stone. It's just a stone. The symbolism of it is important. You know, in pre-war Jewish Poland, you had 1,300 roughly Jewish cemeteries. There's more Jewish cemeteries than all of North America and Israel combined. Because every village, every city, every shtetl had one or two cemeteries. You know, you have the cemetery that you'd be buried in and the one you'd never go to, right? Jews, right? And almost over 90% of these cemeteries were completely destroyed during the Holocaust by the German Nazis and afterwards by Poles who'd use them to rebuild. And this isn't just a Polish issue. This was everywhere. Like even in Italy, you found stories of Jewish tombstones being used to rebuild cities. And so slowly people would reach out from everywhere wanting to return these tombstones. So that's really what sparked that project.
And I think one of the fascinating things, again, about the juxtaposition is the story of the Warsaw Zoo, where the pavers were made of Jewish headstones. And yet it was also the safe haven for... people don't know how many Jews were saved
over
by the owners of the the Warsaw Zoo, which brings us to the other thing that you do, which is work with people who helped save Jews or hide Jews or feed Jews. So how did you get into that?
Well, that the zoo's a perfect example. They called me there because of the tombstones. They were redoing the zoo, and they found that the paving stones there were made from tombstones. And I didn't know the story of Jan and Antonina Żabinski, who were the zookeepers, who hid over 300 Jews in Warsaw Zoo. From there, it was a meeting point where they'd go on to other places. And even from the first event that we did with the Knesset in Auschwitz in 2014, we'd invite Righteous Amongst the Nations. You know, Righteous Amongst the Nations are non-Jews who risked their lives to save Jews during the Second World War. Yad Vashem has honored over 27,000 people as Righteous Amongst the Nations. These are just unbelievable people who really risked everything to save oftentimes people they didn't know. And when I started, there were around about 1,000 righteous still alive, and would invite them to events and do things with them and try and help them. And then maybe it was actually in an event that we did in Warsaw Zoo that I invited a man called Józef Wołaszczak, who he was 101 at the time, and he saved 54 Jews. We invite him to the zoo, and he comes by two trams, a bus, and walking in the snow. And like, what's going on, right? How is it possible that this man who saved 54 Jews, even if it was one Jew, but he saved 54 Jews, has to get around like that? Now, there are organizations that send them money, but like, you know, with any old, especially Eastern European, if you give them money, it's either going to go in their mattress or to some like silly grandson, right? Mm. They're never spending it on themselves. And so that's when I was like, okay, we need to do more for them. So multiple times a year, but especially over Christmas, I go and I visit every single living righteous, and I bring them everything they need to spend their holidays with the love and respect and decency they deserve. In Judaism, there's a notion of hakarat hatov, of thanksgiving, of gratitude. And for me, it was quite shocking to see that most of these people were just completely left alone, that no one would visit them, no one would bring them, no one would take care of them. And that didn't sit okay with me. And every time I'd sit and talk to them, I'd ask them, you always try and pull nice memories out as well. Because if you take someone a dark place, you know, they're not going to sleep for weeks after. And every single time they tell me, you know, over Hanukkah, we'd like try and give the Jews a candle. Or on Rosh Hashanah, we'd give them a piece of carp, which is this horrible whitefish. But whatever it was, we'd try and do whatever we could to allow them to celebrate their holidays.
While the war was going on.
While the war was going on.
Hiding them.
Correct, while they were being hidden. And then when it came to their time, and it came to Christmas for them, and especially over COVID, you know, Yusuf, who was 103 by that point, was having to fight for toilet paper. That's not okay, right? So that's when we really stepped up. And I went to Poland, and I was there, I think, for almost a year straight. I was caught there during COVID. And I just drove. I was in 27 countries, all in a car. I had permission to travel through the EU, all the way down to Albania, where the last living Muslim righteous still lived. And would basically bring them and give them the love and credit that they deserved, because they definitely deserve it. And we still do it today.
So a lot of people will be wondering how a 27-year-old, I mean, now you're not 27 anymore.
Unfortunately not.
How when you started, you were 27. How a 27 pulls such things off. And we'll be looking for you for inspiration and for advice. What would you give him?
There's a level of self-belief that you have to have in yourself. And I've always believed, not just in myself, but in anybody. Anybody can achieve whatever they want. It's just that there's not much more than working hard that gets you to places, right? Luck you create for yourself. The rest is hard work. Just work hard and you'll get there. And you have to have the belief in yourself. And I absolutely believed in myself. And even today, you know, I could do whatever I want to do. I'm doing what I want to do, and I'm very, very happy. I go to sleep at night, and my heart is full, and I have full of gratitude, you know, but if I wanted to do another path in my life, I could succeed in that as well. And any of us could. It's graft. It's hard work. I grew up in a family where everybody worked hard. Everybody worked hard. Seeing my parents work, and when I was a kid, my dad, you know, going with him to markets on a weekend, right? that's graft. That's hard work, getting up at 4 a.m, picking up a van, taking baked goods, sending them to the market stalls. You know, we always worked hard. And there, you know, this is the key to succeeding. It's not, there's no like magic wand to wave and suddenly you're going to have success in life. It's work hard and you'll be all right.
But I think that scares a lot of people. A lot of people that want to, you know, be advocates, be activists, want to do good in the world, but they see it as a very daunting proposition.
It is hard, right? It's hard. It's a slog, right? There's none of this is easy, right? It like people may see me on Instagram traveling to all these places and speaking everywhere, and oh, that looks like so much fun. It's difficult. It's hard. I miss my kids, right? You know, I'd much prefer to be at home and chilling and this and like from one perspective, but from the other perspective, you know, I'm also, you know, even when it comes to my children, like I'm giving them a life lesson through this, and they get it, they see it, they know that dad's not around a tremendous amount, but they also know that dad's working hard and working hard to do good, and that's an important life lesson. Now they might complain about it sometimes. Right. But this is the same lesson that I got from my parents and it served me well. And I think that this is just the key to any kind of success. You know, you look at politicians. Who are the politicians that really succeed?
Unfortunately, depending on the system in Israel, it's everyone. The hard workers and the corrupt ones.
It's the ones who really want it. Mm. This is who succeeds. It's to people who really want it. It's those who are there. Now, Netanyahu is a perfect example. You can like him, you can not like him.
You're gonna cost me now. All the listeners are gonna spike or gonna plunge. Like there's gonna be something happening.
So this is apolitical, but it's a fact. And the fact is that you don't have to like him, which is fine, or you can love him, which is also fine. The reason he is still the prime minister, and I'm willing to bet that whenever this goes to air, he'll still be the prime minister, and he'll probably be that in a few years' time as well. And he'll be around in politics even for longer, is because he wants it and he believes in it. This is the reason that he has his success. You look at Trump coming back for a second term. He wanted it real bad and he was willing to put everything on the line for it, which is how he got it. This is how you are successful in life. You don't have to like the people, but you can appreciate the journey that they've been on. And I think that this for all of us, you have to work hard. And that's how a 27-year-old did that. And that's how I'm doing what I'm doing today, right? You know, we the most incredible projects, and we have things that I can't even talk about yet that are coming over the next year that are massive and important and brilliant projects. And that's all from just hard work. No one gave me nothing.
So let's talk about what you're doing today. Of course, things that you can talk about. Many people know you as probably one of the most trusted breaking news source on social media, which to me is a bit interesting because I don't know where you get your news, what your sources are. I don't know exactly, there's no transparency there because you're just a person, yet your hit rate is very high. A lot of times you report it about half an hour before Ynet, which is the biggest Israeli newspaper. So how did you become that to many people?
Like everything else I've done in my life, I identified that there was something missing. I looked around. I hoped someone else would do it. They didn't, so I did it myself. It's just as simple as that. I'm not the kind of person that waits for other people to do something. And when, after October 7th, it felt to me that people were desperate for a news source that was truly unbiased and told the news as the way it should be told without all of the extravagance and fear-mongering that came with that. And, you know, it was too easy to put stories and pictures that would be clickbait and honestly frighten people. And I don't like that. And I felt that there needed to be something reliable out there. Again, after being in the army and working in the Knesset and having an understanding of politics, you're able to decipher the news in a different way, right? A lot of people will hear a news story and go, think, oh my God, right? I hear that story and I see the layers behind it because I understand who the journalist is who wrote that. I understand what the politics went behind that. And when you understand across the platform, you get the situation. And still, I have a lot of friends in high or low places, depends how you want to look at it. And I'm able to call on them to understand the drive here. It took me an hour and a bit to drive here today. I spent the whole time on the phone with people from Israel, understanding what's going on at the moment, because it's just, again, doesn't matter when this airs, there's always going to be something complex going on in Israel. And there are people who I can call from the army or from politics to direct me and give me a better understanding. And so when I give news over, it's always news that's verified, and never something that is going to put myself in a compromising position.
And how do you decide what to report to people, what to highlight?
I base it on what I think is interesting to people and important for people to know. So, for example, there are many things that I skip out, because if I was just sharing the news, I'd be blowing people up all day and every day with never-ending stories. I don't think that's important. I also don't touch stuff that I don't really understand, right? So, for example, American politics, right? I'm not an American citizen. I have no right to vote here. I will not tell people how to vote. In the UK and in Israel, I'll have a different spin on it. But also, I think it's important that I remain somewhat bipartisan and not push a political agenda, because everybody deserves to have a place that they can go to and see a broader picture. And so there are many things that I won't report on and I think are unnecessary. I won't, and I don't attack Israel ever, or anybody in Israel. So there are many politicians in Israel who I disagree with. Some, you know, former prime ministers who have said disgraceful things on TV in America, which impacts diaspora Jewry massively without even realizing it. They're, you know, it's stuff that I completely disagree with, but I won't bash Israel publicly. I don't think that that's the right thing to do. I think that we need to stand united externally. Internally, we can fight all we want, and we do fight a lot. But
it's our national pastime.
Definitely, 100%. But I think that we need to have a voice from a united fashion. And this is kind of how I look at that situation. So the news I share is news that I think is important for people to know, and I think is interesting, but also isn't something that's going to rile people up unnecessarily. Because I see this time and time again, and wherever I go, people stop me and thank me and talk to me. And I see the level of anxiety that people have and the nervousness they have. So one thing I'm very careful of is not adding to that.
It's interesting that you mentioned anxiety, because I was going to ask you about that, which is when your nose is so close to the wall, when you are spending so much time really delving into the news, and the news, at least in the past 20 months, but arguably in the past 78 years in Israel, or even 3,000 years of Jewish existence, the news has not been great. And yet you seem very hopeful. So how do you keep that hopeful mentality? Or maybe not. Maybe at night, Johnny Daniels turns to Jack Daniels.
Look, I like that one. The truth is when, as a student of Jewish history, as you said, we've had 3,000 years of difficult news. And it's never been easy for us. But we got through it every single time. We sometimes pay a high price for it. A difficult price and a painful price, but we get through it. And what we see now today is difficult and not easy, but it's also a miraculous time to be alive. We're alive as Jews today. There's never been a better time for us. Think about it. 80 years ago, when Jews were being persecuted, you know, 80 years ago, October 7th was happening every half an hour. Right? During the Holocaust, mass killings of Jews were higher than any killing on October 7th. We had nowhere to go. The whole world turned their back on us. No one wanted to help us. Today, we have Israel. And this is a miracle. And so with all the difficulty that we see, we control our own destiny. We have literally... No one is going to screw with Israel today. And that's a wild thing to think about.
I want to push back on that, because it seems like a lot of countries screw with Israel.
They can play with us a little bit, but no one's going to take us down. Right? You look at all the major countries, Russia, China, all these. We're doing whatever we want. Look what we did in Syria. Look what's the situation in Syria today. The whole thing's gone. Who stopped us?
So, yeah, I wanted to delve into your mind a bit and understand in your vision, not just of Israel, but the geopolitics of the region. What are the main internal and external challenges for Israel right now, as you see them, as someone who's so invested in everyday current affairs?
There's only two things that are important for Israel, really, and that's Gaza and Iran. Everything else doesn't really matter. And these are the two main issues that Israel has to figure out how to deal with properly. Gaza, there has to be a long-term solution there that makes sense. And to be honest with you, the only thing that really makes sense is to give Gazans the opportunity to leave if they want to. We know that the majority of them do want to leave. And given the opportunity, they need to be able to let to go, because Gaza is uninhabitable. It's impossible. Even if we look at the end of a war with no Hamas, please God, and all of our hostages return, please God, how are they going to rebuild that place? The rubble in Gaza is immense. And that's because of the way that Hamas have fought us. Like cowards, right? Shooting right. from inside of buildings, digging tunnels.
But I would argue, sorry for cutting you, but I would argue, and a lot of people would be listening, would say that's a very convenient solution for the Israeli side. You know, the rubble, and we're in full agreement, is because of the way Hamas fought, but it was due to Israeli bombs. And now when things are turned into rubble, saying you should leave, it's uninhabitable. Understandably, a lot of the world, including many, many Jews, would say that's not a fair equation to make.
Not everything's fair, buddy.
Okay.
Right? That's number one. And number two, again, I'm talking about giving people who want to leave the opportunity. I'm not saying we're pushing anybody out or expelling anybody. Given the opportunity, most of these people want to go. This is the honest truth. And there's been polling time and time again to prove that fact. The problem is no one wants to take them. Right. This was the difficulty that we had until this point, is that no one really wants to give them an opportunity to go anywhere. Right. There are solutions on the table, really viable solutions that give them somewhere to go, that they'll have a better life. And when I talk about the rubble, the understanding of it is that Gaza will be a dangerous and uninhabitable place for quite some time. The estimated time to clear the rubble in Gaza is about 5 years. Then you have a problem. You can't build in Gaza because they destabilized all of the ground by building these tunnels everywhere that we can't allow to continue and be thereafter. They all get blown up. The ground is structurally not sound. Just to deal with that will take another 10 years. So you're looking at 15 years before anyone could even build again in Gaza. Again, that's as a result of the way that Hamas has run that place. So to give these people a better life, they should have the opportunity to leave and go somewhere better for them if they want to. Now, if they want to continue to live there, we have to figure out a way that they live there peacefully alongside us. And if that's not the case, then unfair or not, they got to go. Because we have to be able to live peacefully alongside our neighbors. Now, we know this, as every time we're given the opportunity, we stretch out our hands in peace. Every opportunity. But we also can't forget that this isn't a Disney movie, right? That this is the Middle East. And in the Middle East, there's a different kind of tune that's sung, right? And it's sung through strength. And it's not maybe the nicest thing to say, and it doesn't sound great. And from a politically correct world, you know, kumbaya, and let's just sit together and hold hands, it's impossible. If only, right? You know, and it's not, who knows what happens in the future? You know, if we were having this podcast 40 years ago, we wouldn't be talking about the Gazans, we'd be talking about the Egyptians, our mortal enemy, right? They took Israelis captive, they started every war, and it took one unbelievable prime minister in Israel, Menachem Begin, right? And Sadat, the president of Egypt at the time, to reach out their hands and create a peace that's really strong until today. So maybe there's hope in the future, but it has to come from them at least wanting to live alongside us with peace.
And what about Iran?
Iran, look, again, the best thing we can hope for is a regime change in Iran. And there isn't any question that Israel has to act when it comes to Iran. Iran are, you know, the Islamic Republic who run Iran at the moment, the Ayatollahs are not rational players at all. There's a rationale that a normal person will have, right? Attacking Israel is a stupid idea. Picking a fight with us is a stupid idea. They have no air defense at the moment. This is known internationally. They're in big trouble. Big, big trouble. Israel can do whatever they want inside Iran. The surprises that Iran have coming for them, the beepers are nothing. You have to be really irrational to want to pick that fight. And when you're dealing with irrational extremists, sometimes you have to take the fight to them.
Now, you know, in before all of this, I used to teach.
Yeah.
And I used to teach negotiation. And I was never kumbaya, you know, let's hug it out. But I would always remind my students that if you solve issues with power, then you must always make sure that you are the more most powerful one, which brings us back to the beginning of the conversation of like why we have to spend so much on defense in Israel. Are you not concerned that if we solve everything by power, then it's almost like putting on a band-aid until the other side is more powerful?
Look, power is also deterrence, right? And this is what we see in the Middle East. There isn't the issue with the Palestinians isn't something with the Gazans now isn't something that's just new, right? This has been 100 years, right? You had the pogroms in Hebron in the 1920s. This is something that's been happening for a very, very long time. There is no ultimate way to end this war, right? This is, at the end of the day, unfortunately, from their perspective, falls into some kind of religious fervor, right? Which is their skewed view of Islam and so on and so forth. There isn't a real way to end this. Anything that we do is just a band-aid. This is the unfortunate truth of the region that we live in. And this has also just been history. These aren't people who are going to back down, if only, right? So, correct. If you make negotiations from a place of strength, you have to remain the strongest person. Look, we in Israel made the mistake prior to October 7th and we forgot that we were in the Middle East and thought that we were Europeans, right? We're not. We're in the Middle East. We have to be tough. And it's not the nicest thing and we wish we didn't have to. You know, I have two beautiful daughters. They're both, you know, my eldest is almost 16. She'll be going to the army soon in a couple of years' time. Already planning for it and where she's going to go and what unit. There is nothing more that I'd like for then my daughter not to have to go to the army and for her to go straight to university and run on with her life and have an amazing time. But she'll have to, because unfortunately this is the region we live in. And, you know, again, if only we could make peace. Shai, there's nothing more that, you know, how wonderful would it be to have hummus in Beirut, right? And travel to these countries. How amazing. We, you know, as Israelis, this culture is so intertwined because of all the Jews that were expelled from these countries. The majority of Israel are Sephardic Jews who come from these cultures. We know this culture, and it's a comforting culture. The majority of popular music in Israel today stems from Morocco, from Lebanon, from Syria. These are the tunes that they sing, right? The Ma'awalim, right? This is this part of our culture. We wish we could live peacefully alongside of them. And given the opportunity, I don't think there's anybody besides maybe some wackos who disagree with that. And this is all we can hope for.
So we're recording this in 2025, 50 years into the future, 2075. What's your vision for Israel?
I think Netanyahu probably won't be the prime minister by that point.
Well, you never know with him. He's got a way of staying around.
He really does. I think that might even be a little bit too much for him. But 50 years down the line, you know, I think we're only going to be stronger. We're going to be in an incredible position. I think that we're going to see regional partnerships that we hadn't seen until this point. I think we're going to be able to drive to Saudi Arabia by car and have a wonderful, wonderful holidays. you know, skiing in the north and coming down into Syria. I think and hope that we're moving in that direction. I think that we have a lot of stuff internally to sort out inside of Israel in the meantime. And I think we're pushing in that direction. Demographics of Israel will be different by that point, right? Very different, right? You're going to have a lot of young religious people who hopefully will be more integrated into Israeli society. But I think that the future is only positive for us. I truly believe that. I think that the vast majority of Jews will be living in Israel by that point. And we're just going to see more incredibleness from Jews around the world doing wonderful things.
All right, we're recording this, and in 2075, we'll check. We'll see if you got it right. So we're going to end this with the Here I Am lightning round, a series of rapid-fire questions. There's no right or wrong answer. It's just first thing that comes to mind. Johnny Daniels, what is one thing people don't know about you?
I hate ice cream.
We should cancel this episode. I don't know why we're talking.
Exactly.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
They don't know how amazing we are.
What is your favorite curse? Any language?
Probably Kusemik.
I love it. You know, one of the most prominent curses in Hebrew is actually in Arabic.
Exactly.
When was the last time you cried?
Like 2 days ago. I cry often. It's stupid. Like I happy situations set me off. Hmm. So I don't cry because I'm sad. I cry like a movie will make me cry. Some young kid moved to a Jewish school, and I was over the weekend watching my girlfriend's nephew, who's like 1.5, singing Hatikva, made me cry. That stuff makes me cry. I cry a lot. I'm a big crier. Yeah.
If you could have any Jewish person over for a Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
I mean, there's so many, from King David to Menachem Begin and everyone in between. I mean, I'd have a big dinner. But if recent history, it'd have to be Menachem Begin. His history and his journey fascinates me as someone who went through what he went through, and his vision and his deep belief in his identity. I'd love to get in with him and really understand who he was.
What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Yom HaTzmaut. Independence Day. Israeli Independence Day is my favorite day of the year.
What is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Yom Kippur. I don't like the fasting.
When do you feel safest?
Where do I
feel? When or where?
When do I feel safest? In the car when my dad's driving.
When do you feel least safe?
Where do I feel least safe?
I had a sense you'd have a difficult time answering that question. You seem like a person who's, you know, really comfortable in their skin and in the world.
I feel safe pretty much everywhere. I feel unsafe when I'm outnumbered and I can't blend in. So for the one place that I felt very unsafe was when I traveled to Ethiopia. I felt incredibly unsafe because I stuck out so much, and I did not like that feeling. I like to blend in, but...
What gives you hope?
My children.
Finally, every episode I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
Well, besides my foundation from the
depths. And I will mention your foundation from the depths.
Yeah, of course. That makes a difference in Israel and around the world. I think it's important also for people to take care of their own communities. And I think that organizations like Hatzalah, that are in every community in the diaspora, pretty much, and their own ambulance services, and the work that they do is remarkable in terms of helping and protecting. And I think people need to give to that, and also to Jewish security companies as well, or organizations. Like in the UK, you've got the Community Service, Community Security Trust, who do an unbelievable job of protecting Jews. And here in America, you have great organizations as well.
Johnny, where can people find you? Don't give out addresses online.
Oh, no. probably in the streets of Tel Aviv or New York. But if not, you can find me on Instagram under Johnny Daniels.
Johnny Daniels. This has been a fascinating conversation. I feel we can deeper and broader at the same time, but we're running out of time. So I'll have you back next time you're in New York City.
Looking forward to it.
And I'm just happy to say here I am with Johnny Daniels.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."